This is Richard Barone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Ralph Ertinger. Today is February 8, 2006, and I'm in Lubbock, and Colonel Ertinger is in Austin, and it is around 1:36 p.m. Central Standard Time. Sir, let's revisit something that we had talked about in our previous session, and that is your thoughts and feelings on communism and what was happening in the world as you saw it in the 1950s and 60s.
Yes, well, I was stationed at Clark Air Base in the Philippines with Air Rescue Service from 57 to 60, and I just was caught up in general affirmation of the realization, from my perspective, of the threat of international communism. The Soviet Union was very strong, China was on the build. And there was just no doubt in my mind that that was a legitimate threat. Mm-hmm. And as I conducted my service in the Philippines, we were primarily concerned with orbiting on station to provide navigational aids for other aircraft transiting the Pacific, as well as, of course, rescue missions for mm-hmm. military and civilians. Mm-hmm. But there was one occasion in which, for some reason, we were called upon to support some international aid materials into Vietnam at Vientiane, as I recall.
That would be in Laos.
Okay, that was Laos then.
Which makes it even more interesting that you're doing that.
And so we went into Laos, and I don't know, we were talking about the various kinds of things in the aid program, and sewing machines seemed to be a significant part of our aid. Yeah, that was Laos, Vientiane, Huck Mountain. I brought back a couple of marble souvenirs, a little urn and a set of carved fish. Mm-hmm. So we were involved in international aid, and it may be that we took a load of sewing machines into Vientiane. But just in general, I think my feeling, and that, as far as I know, of all of us in the unit, without much political discussion at all, we just accepted the fact that international communism was a legitimate threat. And as things unfolded with our increasing involvement in Vietnam, it just seemed appropriate. Mm-hmm. And in retrospect, looking back upon the Vietnam experience, most of us in the military didn't like the political constraints on our involvement. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we weren't so sure that we wanted to go any extremes in invading China and so on. Mm-hmm. But the domino theory was one that I subscribed to, and I think in general, all of my contemporaries did. Mm-hmm. So just in general, that's sort of the posture that I found myself in at that time.
Okay. Well, obviously, this kind of global communist threat was on the lips of everybody in Washington, the policymakers. Did you feel that Eisenhower and then Kennedy and then moving into Johnson, and we'll get into some of the Vietnam stuff in more detail in a bit, but just in general, what was your opinion and your feelings at the time of how these leaders of the United States handled this global threat?
Well, on a macro basis, generally supportive. On a micro basis, various judgments were questionable. Mm-hmm. The Tonkin issue, which Johnson used to escalate our involvement, based on today's knowledge, seemed to have been fabricated. But at the time, there were no indications of that type. Mm-hmm. So I suppose, in hindsight, you might have some opinions different from what we had at the moment as things were transpiring. And in general, I guess we were supportive of how things went.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's continue with your career. We talked about the C-47 instructor pilot time period you spent at Randolph Air Force Base in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, you went to Fort Benning, Georgia to transition into the Caribou.
Right.
I really would be interested in hearing your description of this unique airplane, the Caribou, and how it handled from a pilot's point of view.
Well, from my particular military experience, it was a wonderful gift and a marvelous experience. I thoroughly enjoyed my twin-engine experience, beginning with my first assignment in the Philippines with the SA-16 Grumman Transamphibian. It had overhead throttles with two engines, as did the Caribou.
Uh-huh.
So I was extremely comfortable with the cockpit configuration. The Caribou, from my perspective, having flown the SA-16 and then the C-47 in both the instrument and transition programs at Randolph,
mm-hmm.
the Caribou was a marvelously more powerful aircraft. And I loved the short field takeoff capabilities of it and the short field landing capabilities. So for me, it was just absolute fun, and I loved it.
Tell me about the short field takeoff and landing capabilities. How short are we talking?
Well, it had a unique flap system called the Fowler flaps, which extended the wingspan significantly, increasing both drag and lift.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what made it possible for the short field takeoffs and landings. On an extreme basis, I think we could land in as short as 4,000 feet and less, and take off in slightly more than that, depending on our weight load.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, I just read recently that the Australian Air Force is looking into a major rehab operation to continue using the Caribou in Australia because of its unique characteristics and payload, and that no aircraft since then has duplicated that capability as economically. We have other aircraft which can even take off vertically, but they're extremely expensive aircraft and more expensive to maintain.
Mm-hmm.
So I read that they're looking at some new engines, I think, from England to put in them, but that basically the aircraft is the same. The Havilland aircraft was produced in Canada. So it was a lot of fun. And in Vietnam, I wound up being a standardization and evaluation officer in the unit,
mm-hmm.
and developed circling tactics and what have you so that we could circle down over an airfield, minimizing our exposure to enemy fire and land in the short field. So for me, it was a lot of fun. I say that in contrast to many of the pilots that came into the Caribou program from both Military Airlift Command and Strategic Air Command,
mm-hmm.
where they were accustomed to prior experiences in very large four-engine aircraft, either turboprop or mostly pure jet, and accustomed to long approaches and long landings and long takeoff runs. So for them, the transition into the Caribou was a bit more startling and required some new techniques to be developed. But for me, it just fit like a glove. So that's why it was so enjoyable for me.
Can you describe the airplane physically? You know, what it looked like, what its payload was, and you know, maybe the length and width of
golly,
its wings?
Oh, golly. I'm sure you have that data available in the literature.
Sure. But from your opinion, what do you remember about like what you could and couldn't carry? I mean, how much room was back there?
Well, it's a relatively small aircraft. It seems to me our payload might have been on the order of 6,000 pounds, perhaps 3 tons. And we typically carried 20 to 30 people. and or pallets of materials that were loaded from the back end. It had a ramp which lowered in the back, and we would carry ammunition and foodstuffs, live animals quite often, and combinations thereof. We might have a load of indigenous people, civilians, but more commonly Arvin, the Vietnamese military, and a combination of supplies that would go with them, people. So it was a modern version, you might say, of the C-47. It was somewhat similar, a little more payload, a little more power, a lot more convenience, having the ramp lowered in the back, similar to a C-130, a four-engine turboprop.
Mm-hmm. Now, at Fort Benning, you trained there for a few months. Did you feel, I mean, you said it was pretty pretty easy for you and enjoyable.
Absolutely.
Was that enough time for everyone to train up? And
oh,
I'm
sure it was, yes.
Okay. What kind of training was it? Was it classroom and flying, or was
yes.
it mainly flying?
Yes, combination.
Okay. And when you first got into that Caribou, what did you feel? What were your thoughts about it? And I've heard a lot of stories about the Caribou, and mainly very, very positive things, like you just said.
Yeah.
What were your first impressions of this airplane once you got into it?
Oh, I had seen pictures of it before, and I just felt like it looked like an unusual aircraft, but well suited to the purpose for which it was designed, as a bush aircraft to land on relatively unimproved fields, and nicely designed. Looking at it, it would appear to have a rather grotesque, unusually high tail, which was required because of the short takeoff run and a rather extreme upward pitch angle, so that you didn't drag the tail. But, yeah, I don't know what else to say. A little different-looking airplane, but nice. And then first flying it, compared with what I had been flying, it was wonderful to hear the roar of those engines.
Right. Well, you received your orders there at Fort Benning to actually deploy over to Vietnam. What do you remember about when you received your orders and your feelings then?
Oh, no particular feelings. We knew they were coming. And if I remember correctly, I didn't have final orders. The orders were to Saigon, and then I was redesignated, I think, to the specific location once I got there, which was at Vung Tau. And I didn't realize it at the time, but it turned out that Vung Tau was the Vietnam in-country rest and recreation place also. Some forces would be sent there from other parts of Vietnam to rest and recuperate. It's sort of Vietnam's version of the French Riviera.
Yes, yes. Was it strange to be stationed at such a place?
Well, of course, it's a strange country, strange compared with the United States, but not particularly strange for me, having been stationed in the Philippines previously. And so I had no super feelings of how weird or how strange it is or how exotic. The degree to which I might have had such feelings, I suppose, I had them in our first assignment to the Philippines. And even there, we'd previously been in Libya. So Foreign Service had by that time become relatively routine, and I felt pretty much like an international citizen.
Okay. What were your first impressions of Vietnam?
Well, goodness. My introduction to Vietnam was landing at Tan Son Nhut, the airport in Saigon, and it was a major airport. So I guess that experience was just, I don't know, not particularly illuminating or spectacular, just another big airport in a major metropolitan area. indigenous personnel didn't seem particularly different from those in the Philippines. I suppose I had an early appreciation for the distinct dress of the high percentage of the people wearing, I forgot what you call the women's garment, but the...
The aliyai.
That's it. Long flowing garment, quite attractive, and sort of pajama trousers, very common in both males and females in civilian attire. I had a very early impression of simplicity on the part of the majority of the Vietnamese, and a pretty early impression that, golly, most of them really were more concerned about where the next bowl of rice was coming from rather than being caught up in politics. And the degree to which we interacted with them, Americans were perceived very favorably in our association. So I don't know what else I might say.
Okay. What was your exact assignment? How was that explained to you? What you all would be doing there in the 61st Aviation Company?
Caribou pilot, CV-2, which is what it was called with the Army. And started out as a co-pilot, and in short order was upgraded to first pilot aircraft commander. And as my experience unfolded, I guess I became a flight commander and chief of Stanaval for a period of time.
So they put you first as a co-pilot, what to see how the airplane flew over in that territory and what you would be doing?
Yes.
Okay. Can you remember what that was like, your first flights out over Vietnam and the missions as a co-pilot?
Oh, just interesting, and as far as flying goes, sort of a lot of fun. This was with the Army until the 1st of January, and so we were basically Air Force guys working with and for the Army under Army control, and things were somewhat loose to a very significant degree. Aircraft commanders got their initial frag order of where to fly and what the purpose was. And typically, we did not have orders that carried us through the day, and we would quite often respond to requests as they were passed on at intervening stations. We'd land at one place and they'd need to have us carry some materials or people from their field to another field, and so we would do that, and then we'd get there and perhaps they'd have something that they'd want us to take someplace else, or by the time we got there someone else had relayed a request. So my impression was that things were somewhat looser than what we had been accustomed to, although I hadn't flown missions of that particular type, but that was pretty loose. And then later on, under Air Force control, we had central control, and we pretty much had our missions planned out and knew where we'd be going all day long. I might say that there was a tremendous variety of missions that we had. There were occasions when I would fly as many as 23 or 24 different sorties, a sortie being a takeoff and a landing from one place to another. And so sometimes in the course of a day, and the day might vary from, typically 8 hours to sometimes as much as 16 or 17, most commonly 8 to 10 or 12 hours. So we might have one long mission and a return to Vung Tau, and that would be it. On other occasions, we would more typically have a series of sorties, perhaps 8 to 12, but on occasion, as many as 24.
What kind of missions exactly were you flying?
Primarily military support of special forces. I'd say that was the reason we existed, probably. The special forces typically were in locations where a small airstrip would need to be developed, initially just bulldozed out, and then eventually pierced steel planking would be put in place. And they would be very short field, in many cases immediately adjacent to a special forces camp, which would be built up with a combination of trenches and sandbags and watchtowers and barbed wire and such things.
Mm-hmm. And you would take all of these supplies out there to them?
I don't know about the all. If there were airstrips adequate, and there would be in some fields, there would be 123s and possibly even 130s coming in.
Right.
And in some cases, particularly when they'd be under attack, you'd quite often have aerial drops. That was not a common procedure for us at Vung Tau, but we did practice them. We were proficient in both airdrops and what we called LOLEX, low-level extraction, in which we would fly in at treetop level, come down just skimming the ground with our cargo door open, and at a given signal, the cargo would be pushed out in most cases with a parachute helping pull it out and slow it down as it hit the ground. Mm-hmm. In a few cases, just shoved out without a parachute.
That sounds like amazing flying. How long did it take you? How long did it take you to learn something like that?
Oh, I suppose you could say that you never learn it completely, and the more you did it, the more proficient you became in terms of knowing exactly when to call the signal for extraction and have it come down exactly where you wanted it to. But I think we had some of that training at Fort Benning, and it was just a matter of a refresher. I suppose some people never learned it, and they dumped their loads beyond the field, and some were right on the spot. So I suppose you could say it might take a series of five practice sessions to learn it. But having said that, how well you learned it and how much you improved with practice would be a variable.
Okay. Would you mind describing how you do that when you come into you're down on treetop level like that and how difficult that is?
Well, you circle the field, you see exactly where you want to set it down. And in that process, you determine at what point you're going to lead the extraction. So that as the chute pulls the cargo out and under recognizing the delay in having people get it shoved out, you've got rollers in the back of the aircraft, mm-hmm. and the rollers extend onto the ramp. So when the signal is given for extraction, you simultaneously, the crew in the rear of the aircraft puts pressure on to push the load out, and it simultaneously, as a pilot, you nose up the aircraft so that the aircraft is pitched up and it makes it easy for the load to roll out the back. So it's a matter of judgment how much you need to lead, the point at which you do all this, so that by the time the load is out, the parachute grabs it and slows it down, it hits at the front end of where you want it to land, and then it slides on down the space where you expect it to slow down.
Mm-hmm. How many times?
And if your judgment isn't right, why, the load might come down at the very end of the drop zone. And I've got to confess, on one occasion, the first time I did this, my load went into a barn-like building, which was at the end of the drop zone. Mm-hmm. So I did not do a good job on that occasion.
How long did it take you to learn how to get that right?
Well, I probably only did it four times in my whole career.
Okay.
And it was sort of an exciting experience each time. And I'd say I probably never learned it to the point where I could predict with absolute confidence that I would drop it at a pinpoint basis.
Mm-hmm.
So you can say I learned it in a week, or you could say I never learned it.
Okay. What kind of crew did you have on board the Caribou?
You're a pilot, a co-pilot, and a crew chief. Three-person crew, typically.
Okay. And how did you all stay together as a team, or would that kind of...
No, we did not have crew integrity. It would vary depending on the unit. To some extent, we tended to repeat as crew, but we really did not have crew integrity.
Was that a problem?
No. The units were relatively small, and we all knew one another, and it was not a big thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about that. Who were you serving with? What was your unit like, the individuals in it?
Well, those of us that went over early typically flew similar aircraft to the degree which it was possible. I had come from C-47 and HSA-16 experience. But I guess that was the intent, to get as many people with that kind of experience in. But even initially, we also had some brand new pilots right out of pilot training, and this was their first assignment.
Mm-hmm.
And we had people from SAC and MAC, many from desk assignments. So we were a very mixed group in terms of experience,
mm-hmm.
but we had the common experience of Fort Benning training before we came over there, so we all knew the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. When I got there, my roommate and I, Tom Martin, were roommates in a small compound where we had a room in Bung Tao, which was sort of across the street from the officers' club, which
mm-hmm.
was a sort of a small hotel with good dining facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And so we lived in there, I guess, our whole tour. But at some point while we were there, we acquired some kind of a little building in which we developed our own little club. We called it the Copa Cabana, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And
this was their...
we built a bar, and we hired a local gal to be our bartender. And so that was our typical gathering spot. It seems to me that may have happened about halfway through my assignment.
This was there, right there where you slept, where you lived?
No.
Was it adjacent to where you lived, or is it within the same proximity?
In the same proximity. I can't tell you exactly what that setup was or what else was with it now.
Okay.
That's funny. Yeah, I don't remember, and I don't remember just what the protective, if that was within a compound or what our situation was.
Well, while we're on the subject, tell me about where you live. What was that that room with Tom like, the quarters in which you live?
Oh, I guess it was a wash, whitewashed, stone or cement block building,
mm-hmm.
with the front door sort of like a motel, I guess, although it was just a room. And we had a couple desks in it and a couple of beds.
Okay. And did you have air conditioning?
By golly, that's a good question. Huh.
I know that a lot of pilots did have air conditioning when they were not out there.
Huh. I don't remember, but I would guess probably we did, because I don't recall being uncomfortable.
Okay.
So I would guess we had air conditioning, yes.
What would you all do with your downtime? I mean, obviously you had the bar there, that's a significant thing, but what would you do with your the time away from flying and really your entertainment?
Well, there were night spots. Restaurants were relatively inexpensive.
Mm-hmm.
So we would eat out on some occasions. We would eat in the club on some occasions. There would be special events.
Mm-hmm.
Once we had our own club, we would typically gather in there. Some guys for the evening, some for a drink or two before we went out to eat. Correspondence was a significant thing for me. Had an extensive regular communication with my wife and my folks,
mm-hmm.
and we had little tape recorders. We would exchange audio tapes back and forth, little cassettes that we mailed back and forth, as well as writing letters.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an Australian caribou unit also stationed at Vung Tau, and we would quite often socialize with them, particularly on a few occasions where there were squadron parties, and they were beach parties, in which we'd have outdoor barbecue and drinks and just general camaraderie on the beach.
Tell me about the Australians. What were they like?
They loved their beer. And they were jovial, good pilots, a lot of fun. Didn't have extensive contact with them, but they were there and they liked the airplane, and it was, as I say, probably more of an institution in Australia than they were in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Did you work with any New Zealanders?
I did not.
Okay. How about South Vietnamese Air Force personnel or any other? You mentioned Arvin. Tell me about the South Vietnamese military. What were they like? What impression did they make?
Well, the only contact that I had with them was in transporting them on occasion.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were, I guess my contact, you could say, was with them as cargo or as passengers.
Mm-hmm.
I never communicated with them as such. That was not a part of our duties. They were not involved in our control, immediate control and conversation. So other than observing them, I wouldn't have a whole lot that I could say about them.
Did you hear about their reputation? What did you hear about them as troops?
Nothing.
Okay. Tell me about the Vietnamese civilians. What did you think of the folks that you know? You said you hired a girl to be your bartender.
Oh, charming.
Mm-hmm.
Generally attractive, nicely dressed. As a matter of fact, mixing with them in town, they were accustomed to serving a vacationing population, so perhaps they were even more cordial and accommodating. Well, I don't know. That's probably the case wherever there were U.S. military, that they would interact with whatever indigenous people were in the surrounding area. But they were very friendly, very accommodating, and I don't recall just how it happened, but I became acquainted with a Vietnamese artist, and I had him paint my family from photographs that I had with me. So I have a painting about 30 by 40 inches that's hanging in our bedroom. The canvas is about 30 by 40 inches, and he did a great job.
Wow. So you were able to mix freely with the locals?
Absolutely.
Tell me about being in an R&R facility. When you go into town, you were seeing men come in and out. And this Bung Tao has a reputation of being this beautiful resort area. What was it like being in this R&R atmosphere?
Well, I don't think, other than knowing it was an R&R destination, I don't think there was any carnival or resort atmosphere per se. Vung Tau is a lovely city on a coastal area, so it was very attractive, and it had a number of restaurants, but I was not conscious at all of any vast number of U.S. military strolling the streets or anything like that. Certainly no more than I would at Benoit or Da Nang or any place else. It was just I would just say that Bung Tao is an attractive town and an enjoyable place in terms of restaurants and the beaches and what have you. So it was nice. And relatively isolated. So I think in general, there was a feeling of much greater security. And certainly during the time we were there, it was before the Tet Offensive. And there wasn't any super sensitivity to security in general wherever we flew.
Right. You're there in 1966. You get there October 1966.
Yeah.
What did you understand at that point why you were there? I mean, obviously to perform your daily missions, but what about the United States and why it was in South Vietnam? Did your view change once you were there and saw it and lived it?
No, I don't think so. I suppose the gnawing question was always there with me. As I had mentioned earlier, the average Vietnamese didn't understand politics. They knew that they were under French domination for many years and were interested in independence. But in general, their main concern was feeding their family and where would their next bowl of rice come from. The Viet Cong and the battle between the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese, the concern about the North Vietnamese dominating the South, that seemed unjust, the notion of encroaching communism. So in combating that, it was legitimate for us to be there. And that view did not change on my part from before I got there until after I had left. And the idea of success or failure, we seemed to be successful throughout the time I was there. And the doubts would come in subsequent years, particularly after the Tet Offensive.
Okay. So I'd like to get back to the Caribou and some of your missions. What missions stand out in your mind? What do you remember as the
most significant
ones?
That stands out in my mind, and I can't tell you where it was right now. I think you've got the documentation probably of wherever it was that I got my Distinguished Flying Cross, but that particular mission was at a field that was under attack, and we had to come in with ammunition. That was one of the few missions that I flew where ammunition was our primary cargo and was urgently required. And that particular airfield had all kinds of activity going on, helicopters flying all over the place, and just exactly how we were going to get in and offload and get out again in a short time was questionable. So that was sort of exciting, and so that mission stands out from that perspective.
What was the action, basically going in into a hot area carrying ammunition and performing well?
What was the action?
I mean, that. Why were you awarded the DFC? What was special about that mission?
Well, it was hazardous getting in, and I hate to heap praise upon myself, but the challenges of getting into a field that's under attack with multiple missions taking place simultaneously and safely getting in and safely getting out in a short field took a little bit of doing.
Mm-hmm.
And we got in safely and we got out safely. So I suppose a survivor can get an award.
Well, tell me about the first time you actually came under fire. Do you remember that?
Oh, I didn't come under fire a great deal. That may have been the only occasion. We would be fired upon whether we knew it or not, and some of our sorties would pick up an occasional bullet hole in the aircraft, not knowing that we had been under fire.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't say that I was exposed to a great deal of hostile fire while we were there.
How did it feel to be under fire? Do you remember your thoughts or feelings, or did you even think about that?
No, I didn't have any particular thoughts. My thoughts were about the mission we had to do, analyzing the situation around the airfield, figuring out just how to get in, how to get out, get it done. And there weren't any particular feelings about the hostile fire. I suppose there had to have been a little bit of extra adrenaline flowing with those circumstances, but all of our missions required an analysis of what was going on, surveillance before you go in, and things looked threatening, just minimize your exposure, minimize your risk.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Caribou, particularly, our primary tactic was to fly in high, weather permitting, and descend in a spiral, and so you're coming directly over the field, minimizing your exposure to any forces that might be away from the special forces camp that could be shooting at you.
Mm-hmm.
So without particularly knowing how great the threat was, we typically would take evasive action, whether we knew it was necessary or not.
Was that something taught to you, or did you all figure that out on the fly right there?
Well, yeah, we figured it out and we taught it. As I say, that was a part of what I caught on to and put into our standing operating procedures while I was chief of Stanaval.
I want to ask you about that. You transitioned from co-pilot to pilot and flight commander. What's the distinction between pilot and flight commander?
Oh, nothing. A flight commander is an administrative role where you supervise a flight involving several air crews.
Okay.
So you just have some additional responsibility besides being a pilot.
Okay. And then you went to flight examiner. What was that role?
As a flight examiner would take a newly assigned pilot after having been instructed by instructor pilots within the unit for his final examination to certify him as an aircraft commander and for proficiency. So it's just a role for a more proficient individual examining a relatively new person mm-hmm. and certifying them. So it's a person who certifies the pilots for whatever level they're being certified for.
Were you trained for that and taught that while you were there at Bung Tao? This position and what your duties were
well,
as an examiner?
I guess that's a part of... as you're trained to be a pilot, that's proficiency. As your proficiency gets to the point where you are accepted as having standards, why, then you just do the same thing that someone else has done with you. So the training is continuous. You're being trained, you could say, to be a flight examiner once you're being trained to be a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Once you achieve the standards you're supposed to have, why, you practice them as you fly more, your proficiency develops. And a chief of Stanoval would typically certify a flight examiner, and that flight examiner at some point would become chief of Stanoval and certify another one. So the training is sort of on a continuum. I'm not sure there's any special training for a flight examiner per se.
How are these individuals, how are you selected to do this? Is this everybody going through this, or were
you selected? Sure, all pilots. So you're just there. If a unit loses a flight examiner to rotation, you need another flight examiner. So the operations officer would look around and who's the most proficient person, and that person becomes a flight examiner.
Okay. Seems easy enough then.
Sure.
What other missions stand out in your mind besides your DFC mission?
Oh. I suppose just generalizing missions in the monsoon season.
Mm-hmm.
While I was there, we would typically fly on visual flight rules or visual flight rules on top, VFR and VFR on top. VFR on top means that you've got an overcast condition that's relatively low, so you can't fly in visual flight rules. So you fly through the clouds, and then you're on top of them, and then you're visual. So you would depart Bung Tao, let's say, and you spiral up until you're above the clouds, and then you fly to your destination. You can't see your destination because of the undercast. You're flying VFR on top, and then you have to let down through the clouds to your station.
Mm-hmm.
When you're on instrument flight rules, you are flying on radio navigation or radar navigation, and you're under direct control of controlling forces on the ground. Well, when I was there, we didn't have that throughout Vietnam, so that's why we had to fly VFR on top.
Mm-hmm.
You'd get to a destination, and you'd have local controllers on the ground that would know who was flying up there, and you could come in very high frequency radio or a radio range, low frequency. In a few cases, an ILS, instrument landing system, and in a few cases, you could make a ground controlled approach, a GCA
mm-hmm.
radar approach.
Mm-hmm.
On a particular mission, I recall having flown to Da Nang, all their radio aids were out, and so we had to fly over the field and just let down in a spiral through the clouds until we broke out on the bottom, and it was pretty marginal. And that was just a little hairy. It was difficult to see and get around. Mm-hmm. So the adrenaline was certainly flowing on that mission.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of routine, another mission flying relatively close to the North Vietnamese border. I made a ground-controlled approach in a heavy rain shower. And we broke out just at minimums, and the field was there in front of us. And that was a little bit exciting.
Can you explain what you mean by broke out at minimums?
A ground control approach is a controlled approach under a radar control where they are following you on their radar, and I, as a pilot, am flying on instruments, maintaining a glide slope, and you watch your rate of descent. Typically, it might be 300 feet per minute that you're descending.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on the particular approach, your minimum typically would be at 300 feet. That means you should be in visual sight of your destination airfield so that you can complete your landing visually. You should see the end of the runway or the runway lights. Once you reach the altitude of 300 feet above the terrain, so that would be the minimum. So as I'm coming down, just looking at my instruments, we're at the point where we're, say, 400 feet above the ground and we don't see the runway yet. And we're just getting to the point where we're 300 feet above the ground, at which point we need to execute a missed approach, where we apply the power again and proceed on our missed approach course and climb up to altitude again. So breaking out at minimums means I'm just about ready to execute that missed approach. And there, through the fog, the low clouds, we can just see the end of the runway. And so we come off with the power and finish our landing and slip right on the runway.
Okay. Can you describe what kind of cargo you would carry? You mentioned that before, but what do you remember carrying the most?
Oh, I think in terms of U.S. military forces, it would be brown boxes of foodstuffs. Could be pallets of frozen steaks and various and sundry foodstuffs. Quite often we would have pallets and crates put together by Vietnamese supply folks. This kind of stuff we would most commonly be picking up at Saigon or Ben Hoa. And it would be crates of vegetables, crates with some hogs in them, and or a combination of forces where we come into a special forces camp. We'd have a load of that kind of stuff. And typically, we might have a load for several destinations. Some of it would be left off at this special forces camp, some at another. And particularly under Army control, while we'd be dropping off some here, we might be picking up something at another. Most commonly, the pickups would be not of this kind of stuff, but of people that needed to go from one place to another.
Tell me about the American troops you carried around. What was your impression?
We didn't carry very many Americans. It was mostly Vietnamese troops.
What were your impressions of the Americans you did carry?
Oh, let's see. Pretty, during the time I was there, could just as well have been in the United States. I mean, they were not grim-faced doughboys like you're getting ready to drop them off in combat. They were generally smiling, jovial, not grim. Folks might be the same as getting on a bus in the United States or an airplane in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Would you talk with them?
Sure. I don't recall any particular conversations. There wasn't no reason not to talk with them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sometimes if we had a quick offload and onload, we would, as pilots, just stay in the cockpit, or at least one of us would. The engines might still be running.
Mm-hmm.
We have a relatively quick offload and onload. But more commonly, we would shut down the engines, and both pilots would walk on back, supervise what's going on, talk with anybody that was around a little bit, get back on and move out.
Would you describe what your typical day was like?
Yeah, my typical day would be get up at 5:30, go over to the club, have breakfast, report to the squadron at maybe 6:30, 6:45. Have our briefing for the mission, climb on the airplane for whatever our departure time was, most commonly probably about 7 or 7:30. Take off from Vietnam, and as I say, during Army control, proceed on to our first destination and take it from there. We might or might not have an idea how long our day would be at that point. Fly anywhere from, I guess for a typical day, fly to one Special Forces camp, offload, onload, fly to another Special Forces camp, offload, onload, fly to Tansanute, unload everybody, pick up a load of materials that they had for us to take to another location, let's say another Special Forces camp. We'd land there. They'd have somebody that would need to go someplace else. We'd take them there. And by that time, we might have a call for to go to another place, pick somebody up, drop them off, and about this time it might be anywhere between 4 o'clock and 9 o'clock at night. We need to get back to Vietnam, to Vung Tau. Fly back to Vung Tau, debrief the day's mission, and go eat. And that might be as early as 3 o'clock in the afternoon, more commonly 5 or 6 o'clock, occasionally as late as midnight.
Hmm. So it really depended on how much you had to fly.
Sure.
And the weather and things like that.
But most occasionally the weather would influence the time, but most commonly it would be how far away our last mission was or how many missions we had. Most commonly, our mission day would not involve the extremes, but would be on the order of 8 to 10 hours. Occasionally, it would be midnight or possibly even later.
Was that difficult flying that, you know, that those many hours, 8 to 10 hours a day in a war zone?
Well, no, because that was not the norm. And you would not have two of those days back to back. And you would, if you had a really late mission like that, you would most likely have the next day off anyway. In fact, most commonly, your missions would be on alternating days.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily, but most commonly, you'd have missions on alternating days.
Okay. And would it be 7 days a week or?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to ask you more, a little bit more about your the kind of the life away from the missions. What were your religious services like? Did you have access to churches or services in that, of that nature?
Matter of fact, we did not. In most of my Air Force career, religious services were a regular part of my life and my family's life. And I guess this experience in Vietnam was the one exception to that. I don't recall attending a religious service in my time in Vietnam. And that was an exception to our military service.
Right. Did your spiritual views or feelings change because of your war experience?
Not at all.
Okay. What was the worst place to fly into?
Worst.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the most difficult is the one that we had talked about.
Right.
Was
there like a location where you all would go, oh, I've got to fly here. That's not
no,
fine.
Because of the characteristics of the aircraft, particularly for me, and I really enjoyed short field work. I just thought that was wonderful. And I never flew into a field where I felt any concern about being able to land it safely and in the distance necessary. So having been experienced to short field landings and reversing the props in the SA-16, that was my bag, and I loved it.
Why did you like it so much?
It was fun flying. It was just, I love flying. It's seat of the pants flying combined with good instrument flying and aircraft, but it was not driving a truck. It was flying an airplane, and you knew you were a part of the machine, and you could feel it, and it was just an exhilarating experience.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of fun flying that airplane. I also enjoyed the SA-16. I also enjoyed the C-47. But you could do more and with the Caribou than the others, and it was more responsive, and it had pretty good power for the size of the airplane.
Mm-hmm. Did you all carry any kind of weapons on your person?
We did. Carried a .38 on every mission.
Okay. And nothing else on the aircraft?
No, every air crew member had a weapon. I think the enlisted typically carried an M16.
Okay. Where was your favorite place to come into? I know you said you liked the short strip flying, but was there a particular location that you went into consistently that you really did look forward to or enjoy?
Oh, Vung Tau, our home base.
Coming back home.
Sure.
Yeah.
Other than that, no. There wasn't any place up. Well, there's where the weather would play a factor. If you had to fly someplace in lousy weather with minimum navigational aids, that's the circumstance that was looked upon by the least favor, because that would be the most threatening, with minimum nav aids, not being able to fly visually. And so that inherently was our most hazardous work.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What is your impression of the enemy, of the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong? I mean, this is somebody, I take it, you didn't really see.
Exactly.
What
the enemy
your...
was pretty much a nebulous factor for us as assault transport air crew.
Mm-hmm.
In the video of the movies that I took there that you have on file,
mm-hmm.
I took some pictures where we had clear weather and flying along, we would occasionally see evidence of smoke from attacks of suspected concentrations of enemy troops.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally we'd go into a special forces camp and have time to be toured around. And I took some pictures of a couple of special forces camps that you have on file. And so we'd have conversations, and vicariously we could share in the special forces experiences where they would go out on firefights and or have come under attack in their compounds. And we vicariously could understand the exchange of mortar fire sometimes. But first-hand experience, I never had any at all in terms of contact with enemy forces.
Okay. You said that you communicated at home quite regularly with people in the United States, and you exchanged tapes. Is that correct?
Yeah.
How did you get access to the tapes? Were you able to buy them there in Guangzhou?
Oh, sure. I probably bought them with me from the United States, but American forces brought their comfort with them from the United States. Any facility of any size had its post-exchange, and you could buy comfort items in the post-exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure they had the videotapes. In fact, they probably had the recorders there also, and cameras and cigarettes and sundries and stuff available.
Mm-hmm.
And the special forces, I suspect a part of what they'd be requesting would be stuff like that that somebody would include, and that's probably a part of what we carried in.
Mm-hmm.
We carried in BX kind of supplies as well as rations and ammunition.
Okay. What else would you all do for entertainment? Do you remember music being a part of your life there?
Well, let's see. I don't remember live music particularly, but certainly there was whatever the equivalent was of boom boxes at that time. And sure, we had music. And I think there were occasions where we'd have unit skits and part of our beach parties, and occasionally in our self-built private clubs. And I think the private clubs thing was pretty common in the military units over there. As far as bands or combos, I don't have any recollection of anything like that at Guangzhou.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that in Saigon, there was off-post entertainment of that type. I never had occasion to go off-post in Saigon or Benoit, so I couldn't elucidate on that. But as far as I know, other than eating in a restaurant, I don't recall any live entertainment in Guangzhou on the part of the economy or on our part in our private military club. That's not to say there wasn't any,
sure,
but I wasn't aware of it.
Did you take an R&R?
I took two of them, as a matter of fact.
Oh, tell me about them.
Went to Hong Kong for an R&R, and I had been to Hong Kong previously while stationed in the Philippines.
Right.
So that was no new experience for me, but I particularly wanted to go because my movie camera that I had brought with me was stolen out of the aircraft one time when I left it in the cockpit on an occasion where we left the airplane, and somehow someone got up there and got it. So I went to Hong Kong and we did our thing, and I bought a new camera, a super high 8, what was it, super 8, I guess, 8mm Canon camera. And but my main R&R was to Penang, Malaysia.
Right.
And I had never been there before. So that was interesting to see a bit of a different culture. It was, in many respects, in some respects, similar to Hong Kong. A great number of shops in a metropolitan area. I recall going to a botanical garden and taking some pictures there and just generally wandering around in a peaceful, nice environment.
How did you pick the name?
Oh, I don't know. I probably had a limited number of choices, and that was the most exotic of what I could have. But depending on the time that you got your R&R, there were limited opportunities. I'm sure I would have selected Australia if I could have gone there. I don't recall if that was one of the places or not. I don't recall what my options were.
Okay. Well, as you moved through Christmas, 66, what do you remember how you spent that Christmas?
Nope. I probably flew a mission. I have no idea. There was nothing special about Christmas.
Okay.
Other than the feeling of being apart from family and missing the normal Christmas.
Right. Well, as you moved into 1967, were you counting the days before your time was up?
Well, that was sort of a routine thing that everyone did, but I don't remember making a fetish of it particularly. We knew when our time was up, and we knew we were working until that time.
Mm-hmm. So there was no short-timer calendar or anything like that?
I didn't have one. A lot of people did.
Yeah. How'd you get along with everybody over there? Was it a tight-knit group?
It was no different from other Air Force experiences in general. If anything, we were more intimate because nobody had extended family with them. And so to an increased extent, we within the unit were our own family.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you were a nightclubber or not, your main routine social outlet was to gather at the club in the evening for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you were drinking a beer or a mixed drink or soft drinks. And that might, for most of us, not have been a part of our non-overseas routines. So I suppose that in itself contributed to extended familiarity and intimacy among us.
Sure. Was alcohol or drugs a problem that you saw?
No, I know that Vietnam is presented as a major contributing factor to a growing drug culture. Within our flying unit, I did not see any evidence of its being a problem at all. And as far as excessive drinking, I would say that I didn't experience it in any fashion any different from a civilian base in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really mean a civilian base, a U.S. base.
Right.
You always have a few problem drinkers in society, and I did not see it in our unit particularly. I think the stereotype is probably of more typically Army units with less limited outlets for activity than we probably had at Song Chau.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you drew closer to your time to leave, I wanted to ask you about something that is controversial, is this one-year rotation policy, and it's different from other wars in the United States history. So what did you think about this one year in and one year out?
Well, I guess I would not understand the controversy particularly. I think since it's unaccompanied without family, it seems appropriate. The special training that was required for us did not seem excessive. And It provided for an equitable distribution of inconvenience. It seems to me it was very appropriate. I know that there are many instances where people that wanted to go again went for a second experience as volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, I'm not aware of any Air Force folks that involuntarily went back for a second tour. So, I was not caught up in any discussions of controversy regarding a one-year rotation period.
Okay. So you thought it was okay to pretty much to do your year and leave versus serving for the entire length of the conflict?
I would not have been happy to have done that.
Why not?
Because I love my family, and 1 year separation is pretty tolerable. More than that sounds pretty intolerable.
Right. Okay. Well, tell me about leaving Vietnam. What was that like? How did you feel?
Oh, I felt fine. I knew from the beginning it would be a year. As the end of the year approached, I acknowledged the year was coming up. There certainly weren't any regrets about leaving. There was a joy of anticipation of reunion with my wife and four kids. So it felt fantastic.
Mm-hmm. What was the flight like home? Did you fly a civilian airline or a military airline?
It was a military contract flight, as I recall. Boring, long flight, but bringing me where I wanted to get to, so that was fine.
What was it like coming back into the United States? Was it strange after being
Not strange. There wasn't any military or anti-war sentiment of any great magnitude at that time.
Mm-hmm.
There certainly was no feeling of rejection among any people that I encountered in coming back. No particular flag waving or anything either, other than the joy of family and church folks welcoming us back.
Mm-hmm. Did people ask you about the Vietnam War, what you did, and did they want to discuss this?
Matter of fact, I don't recall a tremendous amount of interest or inquiry about that. It seems strange, but I don't recall much discussion other than, in general, how was it and what did you do?
Mm-hmm.
No particularly great curiosity.
Did you find it surprising at the time? Did it bother you?
No, I didn't have any particular feeling about it. I guess the war was not particularly controversial, I think, through my return in of October of 67.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, the main thing was, gee, nice to have you back again, Ralph. And I guess I should say that our home church was a very important factor for us. Our pastor was a very frequent visitor in our home with my folks and sort of a foster father-grandfather figure within the home, providing support for my wife and my kids.
Mm-hmm. How much did you talk to your wife about what you had done?
As much as she wanted to, I held nothing back. I think the reason there wasn't a whole lot of discussion is because I shared my experience pretty much week by week by audio tape.
Right.
And so my wife was pretty current on the experience, and there wasn't a whole lot we needed to talk about in coming back.
You were pretty forthcoming with her in the tapes, then.
Oh, sure. I wasn't privy to any military secrets particularly, or wasn't asked to keep anything, withhold anything. So, yeah, I had nothing to hide, nothing to held back, and nothing new to talk about when I got back home.
Okay. Did you follow the war on television when you got back? When you came back, you went. You came back in October 67. Where did you go from there? Did you have some time off, or I know you went in 68 to St. Mary's for your MBA.
I had a bootstrap extension to get my master's degree in personnel management, and let's see, at that time I got my assignment to Athens, Greece, didn't I?
Yes, you did. That was coming up.
And so that was sort of an exciting thing for us.
Mm-hmm.
And that required my transition into C-130
right.
turboprop aircraft for the special mission that I flew in Greece. And that mission is a classified mission, and I've never been informed that it was declassified, so I can't really talk about that.
You're talking about the one in Greece?
Yes.
Okay. You're there from June 68 to July 1971.
Right.
And you came back in 71 and you went to Vermont. And
while I was in Greece, I got the assignment to Air Force ROTC. Oh, I felt horrible about that.
Tell me why.
It just seemed out of the mainstream of Air Force activities. I thought it would be a career death knell in terms of being promotion limiting, and I did my darndest to get out of that. And then I was promoted to lieutenant colonel while I was in Greece. I got the assignment as a major, and so I thought, oh boy, they probably won't want me as a lieutenant colonel. So I appealed on those grounds. No, that's fine. So I was assigned as detachment commander then at Northfield, Vermont, Norwich University, which did not have an Air Force ROTC unit. So I was the first professor of aerospace studies and established the Air Force ROTC unit at Norwich University, which is the oldest private military college in the United States, having been established in 1819 by Alden Partridge, who had been a superintendent at West Point, and so the Corps of Cadets was modeled after that West Point experience, and ultimately the Civilian Corps of Cadets at Norwich became the model for the ROTC program as it was instituted and established by the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time I got there, the Army ROTC had been there forever. They already had a Naval ROTC, and we became the Air Force ROTC unit there.
What was it like to establish that and be there in that kind of setting, building it from the ground up?
Oh, it was wonderful. As much as I resisted the assignment, and among other things, I guess the reason I existed is because I had had so little continuity in my Air Force career.
Mm-hmm.
I've often said every assignment I had seemed to be a rather complete change from everything I had done before.
Mm-hmm.
So up until this point, I had been an a technical instructor, and having been trained as a technical instructor, and then I became a flight instructor and was trained as a flying instructor. And now in the academic environment, I was trained as an academic instructor and became an academic instructor, besides all the other stuff that I had done in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a bit disconcerting on one hand, but challenging and exciting, and the antithesis of boredom. And it was a wonderful experience working with the civilian administration and being at once the commander of an Air Force unit and at the same time a professor of aerospace studies with academic credentials in Norwich University, mm-hmm. reporting to the dean and the president and having associations with them.
Mm-hmm.
So it was nice to have a command reporting line through an area commandant reporting to Air University on the military side and with the president of the university on the civilian side.
Mm-hmm.
So, and during that assignment, lo and behold, I was promoted to full bird colonel, and as a result, I stayed on for a total of 4 years at Norwich University.
Well, you acted, you sounded like you were a bit surprised that you were appointed to the full bird colonel. Was that expected for you?
Well, I was hopeful of it, but I think typically to make it to 06, in general, one needs to have a command sponsor and a command identity.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you would more typically be a strategic air command resource.
Mm-hmm.
The Caribou pilots that went to Vietnam from a strategic air command unit after their year in Vietnam would go back to their strategic air command unit,
mm-hmm.
or military airlift command, or tactical air command. Well, I never had that kind of an identity, but in retrospect, I sort of did keep going to education and training, so I did sort of have an Air University identity, perhaps. But with that varied mishmash of a background, I was not expecting to make 06, although I was hopeful of it.
Now, for this, you went to Oklahoma, to Office Air Force Base.
Yes. the circle goes around. My initial activity was as an air electronics officer, and now, toward the end of my career, lo and behold, the electronics picks me up again.
Mm-hmm.
Not having a command identity particularly, here I came into the Air University, and what are they going to do with this colonel of a varied background? So exactly how it came about, I have no idea, but I certainly did not have any informal communication or any pull in terms of assignments. And as always, I went where the Air Force sent me, and so I wound up as a communicator again at Altus Air Force Base in combat communications.
And you were, your position there was deputy commander,
yes.
Fourth Combat Communication Group.
And I was, as an 06, I was deputy commander. My boss was an 06. And that assignment was of limited duration. The unit was identified for deactivation. And so I got a new assignment as, what do you have on your sheet there?
Where you went after Altus?
Where I went to Randolph Air Force, to
Bergstrom
Air Force Base.
Director of the Disaster
Director Preparedness. Director of Disaster Preparedness for the Central United States, yes.
Tell me about that position. What did that entail?
That, there were three areas for disaster preparedness. The Eastern United States, Central United States, and Western United States. Each of them, each of the directors of disaster preparedness was an 06 on active duty, but the disaster preparedness was under Air Force Reserve. So my immediate commander was an Air Force Reserve general at Robins Air Force Base, and our units involved Air Force Reserve, military and civilian technician people within the unit,
mm-hmm.
and we supervised disaster preparedness programs on all of the Air Force bases within our geographical areas, which were active Air Force units. But there were regional centers of FEMA, which most people are familiar, particularly with Katrina in our recent experience. So we had dual military and civilian spheres of influence.
Was that a satisfying assignment for you?
Well, it was, again, challenging and required new learnings. I suppose it would not be perceived as a wonderfully ideal situation where you're not in a typical Air Force chain of command and control. But at this point, I recognized I was in my terminal assignment. I had the opportunity of being able to recognize that, purchase our home with the idea of remaining in place after retirement. And as a matter of fact, somewhat similar to my Air Force ROTC assignment, I did find it challenging and interesting and rewarding.
Okay.
Our concerns at that point were still focused on atomic, biological, and chemical warfare and those kinds of threats.
Yes.
And so we had those things on both a national civilian level as well as a military base orientation.
Mm-hmm. So when you got out in September 1982 after a very long, distinguished, multitask career, looking back on your career, what was the most significant assignment? Which one did you enjoy the most?
I'll tell you, the only valid answer to that is the total Air Force experience. We, my wife and I both just count our blessings and give thanks so often for the opportunity to have experienced the world in such a unique and wonderful fashion, beginning with Libya and the travels that we were able to perform from there, and then the Philippine Islands, and then my experience in Vietnam, and our experience again from Greece and from those locations to have traveled so much, and within the United States to have traveled. And so the experience of humility and wonder and appreciation of what we have as Americans and recognizing the reality of the lives of so many in so many other parts of the world, and to be able to appreciate that more completely, being a part of so many of those populations, as opposed to just quickly traversing a country as tourists.
Right.
To be able to mingle with the local populace and be able to appreciate individuals and the culture more deeply than just rapidly. So it's hard for us to say that any one experience was more significant or more appreciated than any other. Having said that, I personally was fascinated by a particular experience we had while stationed in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. We were able to travel from a vacation resort area in Luzon called Baguio, the winter capital, which is about a mile high in elevation, so it has a very nice climate. But from there, we took an organized tour through the Bontoc and Banawi rice terraces. And they were featured, at least on this tour, as one of the wonders of the world. and indeed I would consider them such, to see mile after mile after mile of these phenomenally beautiful and extensive rice terraces from the base of a mountain to the top of a mountain,
mm-hmm.
Under cultivation by manual labor. Who knows how many centuries already that had taken place. So that was a particularly marvelous experience for us. And for me, competing in wonder with our opportunity to travel up the Nile and see the wonders of the Egypt of the pharaohs, which is also a part of our travel experience.
You did see quite a lot of the world, for sure. I wonder if I could ask you just a couple of general questions about Vietnam before we end the interview. Looking back, what do you think the lessons learned were from Vietnam for the United States?
Beyond my experience, just in general, from our historical perspective today.
Mm-hmm.
Well, from a military perspective, we should not engage in active warfare without having a defined military objective. And that we did not have a defined military objective in Vietnam. And of course, among the various discussions around that were proponents of atomic nuclear warfare to combat the Chinese as they got involved and what have you. I'm not advocating anything of the sort. I'm just saying that it's ill-defined to engage in warfare of a guerrilla type where you don't have a defined objective in which you can say this would be victory.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the United States has learned those lessons?
I think it's a continuing process. I think some might want to draw parallels with that and some of our involvements today, particularly Vietnam and Afghanistan. And I guess I wouldn't want to say that they are the same, but I think a second lesson is that we are pretty naive folks in the United States in having a sort of a know-it-all attitude when we really are pretty deficient in really understanding other cultures. I don't think we understood the Vietnamese psyche and the Vietnamese culture. I suspect that we're rather deficient in understanding the Afghani and the Iraqi, you've got to use the plural, cultures,
mm-hmm.
because even in Iraq, it's not a single culture. And I think we underestimate the result of our involvement sometimes, and what we think might follow logically is based on some faulty premises, based on a lack of understanding of the social, economic, mystic, whatever it is in the indigenous mind and psyche.
Mm-hmm.
Now, exactly what lesson or lessons to be learned out of that, I don't know, other than to be a little bit less confident of projected outcomes or be somewhat more humble endeavor to be more complete and more sophisticated in analyzing a situation.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly appreciating the limits of military power. Military power is an instrument of national power, but it's not necessarily the decisive instrument that we tend to think that it is.
Mm-hmm. What about for yourself? What kind of lessons did you learn for yourself?
What lesson did I learn for myself? Well, not necessarily in life, but in general, life is a continuing learning process. And in life, I have learned and continue to learn many things, such as I am not perfect. There are limits to my control. Ultimately, the only complete control I can exert is the control over myself. Mm-hmm. What did I learn?
What about, let's say, a significant thing that you found out about yourself there? Or a significant experience that affected you?
No, I think I could not say anything about a single significant experience. I tend to look upon the whole as the experience. And appreciate every day on its own and every moment as a moment to be appreciated and savored. And whatever contribution I make is a partial contribution among those of others with whom I'm associated. I, as an individual, have unlimited potential, but I, as an individual, have limited impact. I don't know, that probably adds up to humility. Mm-hmm. I don't know what more to say about it. I can't give you any specific talking points, spectacular, reportable incident of great consequence.
Okay. Well, tell me, have you seen movies or read books on the Vietnam War? And if you have, what's your opinion of them?
Oh, yes. I think typically the movies very, 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 very greatly dramatize the individual GI American participants' experience. In that, the typical experience of an American in Vietnam during the time I was there, and my exposure to even the special forces on the ground, was one of great boredom, punctuated by periods of great terror. Mm-hmm. So those periods of great terror and spectacular firefights and such are what provide the drama of Vietnam movies, which tend to make that appear on a continuum of day-by-day experience. But for the average American soldier in Vietnam while I was there, those are exceptional moments. And for most, only that. Now, for some, it may reflect a majority experience. But for the majority, particularly during the year that I was there, the average GI experience was rather humdrum, as opposed to as dramatic as the Hollywood movies would make them seem.
Okay. Any books that you've read that are significant to mention?
No, I'm sorry to say I cannot point to any books and how they reflect what my experience has been.
Okay. Well, sir, let me ask you about this oral history interview. How has it been talking about your experience in Vietnam and really your whole career, but really the war experience you had there?
What is the question?
What has been your experience of this oral history interview talking about?
My experience and our talking with one another?
That's correct.
Appreciation that you're interested and that there probably will be some wisdom from the accumulation of interviews and what they distill down to, as opposed to making too much of any one interview.
Right.
And so I appreciate what you're doing from that perspective. I am very surprised at the amount of time you're allocating to this interview and the depth to which you're inquiring into just about anything you can think of, I guess. So I'm a little surprised that you would take as much time as you are to talk to me.
Okay. Well, sir, we're going to end the interview now, and I want to thank you for your time and doing this with us.
Good.